next case, which is U.S. versus Wade.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Cronin, and I'm the lawyer for the appellant, Gary Wade. The crux of our first argument on appeal is reflected in the quote from St. Augustine that God does not command the impossible. It's our position that when the district court treated Gary Wade as if he had refused to comply with drug testing, that the court, in fact, required the impossible of Gary Wade. A man who, as this court knows, did not have a telephone, was required to contact by telephone a urine collection office that did not have the telephone staffed regularly.
Did he have a cable TV?
He did have a cable TV, Your Honor. He may have made poor choices in how he allocated his resources.
Well, that's the problem with why people get their probation revoked, is they make poor choices.
Of course, the problem, Your Honor, is not simply Gary Wade's lack of a telephone. It was that Hearst and Associates, which consists of a married couple, the Hearst, were infrequently at the telephone that they had in the county probation office, and that they had no mechanism for Gary Wade or anyone else, apparently, to leave a message for them in their absence.
It seems to me that all of this was known and knowable at the time the probation conditions were, or the supervised release conditions were imposed. And, you know, Mr. Wade is not the only person without a phone. You have to call in. The burden is on the person to comply with these conditions, even if it's hard to do it. The probation officer was reachable. Mr. Wade could have said, I'm trying to reach the testing facility and I can't do it. Could I have a modification? Could you change who it is? I mean, there are many paths other than simply not doing it that are available.
I certainly agree, Your Honor. Of course, at the revocation hearing, it was suggested on Mr. Wade's behalf that the court consider a modification to use a sweat patch.
But
rather
that was
than
a little late in the right. day. I mean, you're not saying he couldn't contact his probation officer.
Actually, Your Honor, I'm certainly not saying categorically that he could not have contacted his probation officer. There were difficulties in contacting his probation
officer. Well, he could have contacted you.
Once I was appointed, Your Honor, which was only very shortly before the revocation.
Oh, that hearing. You were appointed right before the revocation. So he. But what about his prior counsel?
Your Honor, that's a point well taken. Apparently, Mr. Wade did not do so.
Now, I'm thinking along the lines of my colleagues. I mean, he could have taken action. Because he could have contacted prior counsel, he could have talked to the probation officer, gotten to the probation officer's office and explained that there was this problem, left a message for the probation officer certainly had messages.
Your Honor, one problem is that the probation office was well aware of this problem in communication before filing the petition. The
response, but he was also failing to submit these monthly reports as well, right? This isn't just a drug testing problem.
No, it's not, Your Honor. Mr. Wade conceded that he'd been late with some of his reports.
Lots of his reports, right?
It's unclear how many reports he was late with. There were certainly 3 out of 7 reports that he was late with. The December 03, January 04, and the report which was received on June 7th, which was, of course, 2 days after the June 5th deadline. Mr. Wade's position was that he had mailed all of the reports, but that the Postal Service did not deliver them to the probation office.
Now you make out Effingham to be a pretty benighted place, I have to say.
Well, Your Honor, I think I certainly think that any time there's an argument that I mailed something and the Postal Service didn't deliver it and that there was a pattern of this, that is a difficult argument to make, and there's going to be some skepticism. And Mr. Wade and I recognize that in the district court. But
And then the other problem you have is this is the second time he was revoked. So, you know, it makes it hard, you know, when it was explained to him, right? This was his second,
yes.
Right? Because
yes.
in the first one, he failed to file timely reports and notify the probation officer when he moved and to tell the officer he had an encounter with law enforcement. So in terms of heightened knowledge or sort of understanding the ramifications of what happened if you don't follow the conditions, he was keenly aware of that, I would think.
He was painfully aware, Your Honor. Unfortunately, it seems that there may have been some carryover from this problem with not filing the reports on a timely basis to the evaluation of his claims of difficulties with Hurst & Associates, which were much more supported by the record. The questions earlier were along the lines of, well, what if he had contacted previous counsel? Well, previous counsel may have had no better luck in contacting the hearse at this telephone, which they manned only infrequently, than Mr. Wade himself did.
But then if the court has imposed a condition, this is generally true. You don't just decide for yourself you're not going to comply with it. You maybe need to go back to the court and file a motion for some sort of modification. Counsel could have done those kinds of things, as opposed to having him just simply take this into his own hands, decide what's feasible and what isn't, and expects to stay out on supervised release. That's my problem.
Your Honor, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to argue that Gary Wade made the best of his unfortunate lot. The problem is that he's facing right now, he is serving the upper end of the guideline range recommended by Chapter 7 of the guidelines for these grade C violations, which include failure to submit your analysis to an office that is manned only sporadically, where I, as his lawyer, as this court is aware, went there, was told that that office was not in that building. When I confronted the staff there with the fact that, no, in fact, Hurst & Associates was there and that they're responsible for urine collection, I asked if I could leave a message and was told, no, no one in this office knows how to contact them. This was someone with better judgment could have made better choices and reacted differently. We take our clients as we find them, and it's respectfully submit that the district court had other options which it failed to consider, and that it made an error of law in finding that these poor judgments constituted an outright refusal to comply with drug testing. I'd like to reserve my remaining time, please.
Thank you. Mr. Crow.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is James Crow, and I represent the United States of America in this matter. Your Honors, as you're aware, the government seeks for this court to affirm the judgment of the district court in which the appellant was found guilty of violating two separate conditions of his supervised release, and to further affirm the sentence of 12 months of incarceration imposed on the appellant pursuant to those findings. As this court has cited in its discussion with Mr. Cronin, the refusal to comply with the urinalysis provision of the supervised release was not the exclusive basis for this revocation. The defendant also failed to submit timely reports on two instances and, in fact, in three separate instances, failed to submit any monthly reports at all. And that is one of the same bases for which the defendant was previously revoked on a prior occasion. So, as the court has pointed out, the appellant was well aware of the potential consequences that could ensue from his failure to comply with any condition of his supervised release.
Now, Mr. Crow, his underlying offense was a controlled substances offense?
It was. It was a conspiracy to contribute cocaine and cocaine base, Your Honor. So there was a nexus between that condition and the underlying offense. And while the record does reflect there was never any evidence of him using drugs at any particular junction. The record is also clear that he failed to comply on several instances with the request, both in writing from the probation officer and the oral communication from the probation officer directing him to contact this particular drug specimen collection agency on a daily basis.
But you have to admit, Mr. Cronin's description of these of this Hearst group is suggests that they were a pretty sorry drug collection focus for the court to use.
Even if that were the case, Your Honor, I don't disagree, Your Honor. But even that being the case, here we have, as Judge Cuddy has pointed out, an individual who elects to contract for cable television in lieu of contracting for a telephone, which would not only provide him with the means to contact affirmatively that particular office, but would provide them with the means to contact him in return.
Yeah, that's Judge Caney, by the way.
Excuse me, Judge Caney, to apprise him of the fact that he would be required to submit on any particular day to drug testing. And in fact, there's no evidence in the record that there was any disability that the from which the defendant suffered that would prohibit him from going daily to this office on his own. He was not employed. He was not under any particular disability. And it's in the record that, in fact, this office was located less than a mile from his home.
So he could have walked there.
Presumably, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to reflect that he could not have done so.
Are you conceding that there is a problem with this particular urine collecting operation?
There is nothing in the record, Your Honor, that reflects that the defendant had difficulties in contacting this particular agency that I'm aware of. We do have the proffer of Mr. Cronin and his own personal would-be investigation, which he conducted. However, what we do have in the record is that, in fact, individuals from that particular agency came to the defendant's home on several occasions to deliver him to their offices for purposes of delivering a sample, which I believe the district court found to constitute extraordinary efforts made by that agency to facilitate the defendant's compliance.
I know now what the record reflects, but are you aware of any problem with that group?
I'm not, Your Honor. This is my exclusive contact with that particular agency has been this case. So I submit to the court what we have here are two separate grade C violations, either of which provides a basis for the sentence which was ultimately imposed by the district court, albeit at the high end of the range suggested by the policy statement of Chapter 7. Either the failure to submit the monthly reports or to submit to your analysis as required by the directive of the probation officer. And with respect to the issue raised by the appellant as to whether or not this failure to comply rises to the level of a refusal to comply, I suggest that the court need not even reach that issue because it nevertheless, regardless of whether or not the mandatory revocation and imprisonment consequences of Title 18, 3583G attach here, it nevertheless is a violation of the special condition as imposed upon the defendant as part of his supervised release, and that finding by the district court is not clearly erroneous, given the totality of the record. The district court specifically found that the appellant failed to contact or otherwise make himself available to that agency for urine collections, and he further found that any difficulty in communication between the appellant and the drug testing agency was attributable solely to the defendant and not to that agency. And he further noted, as has the court here, that the burden for compliance rested with the appellant and not with that testing agency. I submit, Your Honors, that in order for the district court's finding to be a mistake, there would have to be some evidence that the defendant's refusal to submit to drug testing in and of itself was somehow mistaken, which is clearly refuted by the evidence. The defendant was apprised of this condition at the outset of his supervised release and was then further reminded of it when he was found to be in violation. I also submit that while a district court is not required to revoke a defendant's supervised release in cases involving grade C violations, Chapter 7 of the guidelines, the policy statements contained therein, provide that generally the appropriate disposition in such a case where a defendant has, as here, been continued on supervision after the finding of a violation again violates the conditions of his supervision. And so notwithstanding the refusal standard, I submit to this court that the revocation and the subsequent imposition of a 12-month sentence of incarceration was entirely proper and was not clearly erroneous. Thank you, Your Honor. I yield the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you. While counsel for the government points out that Chapter 7 of the guidelines presumes that a term of imprisonment would normally be appropriate for a grade C violation, It's critical that there's no reflection in the record that after reaching his findings that the district court recognized that it had the option of doing anything other than impose a term of imprisonment.
Why do you say that? I mean, the district court's discussion seemed to me to reflect cognizance of all of these facts, that there had been a prior revocation because of the underlying offense, and so on. And it didn't read to me like a district judge that thought he had to behave like a robot and, you know, find certain facts and other things happened. I don't know.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the fact that the district court at the beginning of the hearing gave its statement quoted in the government's brief, recognizing that, or speaking of should the court impose a term of imprisonment, that came prior to the findings, not afterwards. After the findings, the court imposed the high end of the range. It imposed imprisonment without any discussion of other options, and it seemed to accept the government's argument that Mr. Wade was, in effect, a lost cause for whom an additional term of supervised release would be wasted.
But the judge characterized your argument as essentially one for leniency, which suggests to me that he knew that a leniency request was before him.
Which I think, given the fact that we conceded that at least some of the reports were late, made some sense. But the district court also said that proposed modifications were irrelevant. And while the court did not have to accept that, saying that they were irrelevant, we believe, was an abuse of discretion.
Thank you, counsel. You were appointed in this case, were you?
Yes, Your Honor, from the Federal Public Defender's Office.
Their court appreciates your participation and argument on behalf of your client. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we proceed to...